You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. We're now in pandemic month 9, and civilization, as we know it in the neighborhood, is hanging by a thread. Ernie the mailman, in normal times just a regular guy and a real sweetheart, has descended into complete and utter madness. Ernie's been observed exposing himself to the statue of Leslie Stahl in our neighborhood town square and disturbing the peace, what little is left of it, by griping in his outside voice to everyone on his route something about leaving his laptop at a repair shop in Delaware and never getting it back.
It's been a year and a half, you... And... You too, you smug Mr. Jones.
And our puppet friend, King Friday the 13th, who previously declared himself president for life, has now claimed the title President for Eternity, along with the divine right of separating young children from their parents and eating them. We took the case to the neighborhood circuit court, which is packed with a majority of pro-life judges, and they ruled in the king's favor. The court took an originalist view of our neighborhood HOA guidelines, decreeing that while life begins at conception, it pretty much ends when a kid's big enough to consume. But on today's show, we take a brief respite from all the hubbub to celebrate our city's most popular literary event of the year, the Portland Book Festival. This year, as with just about every event other than super spreader campaign rallies, the festival is going virtual. Instead of one jam-packed day, it will take place over several weeks entirely online from November 5th through the 21st and feature more than 100 authors, including our guests today, Karen Russell and Liz Crane. Karen and Liz are both good friends of Mr. Jones and two of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. Karen's latest book is a new edition of her 2014 novella, Sleep Donation, from Vintage Books, in print for the first time and with added material, including illustrations and a special nightmare appendix. Liz's new work is the cookbook, Dumplings Equal Love, delicious recipes from around the world from Sasquatch Books, which will have you salivating over the photographs while preparing your own home-cooked shumai, XLBs, gyozas, kreplach, wontons, pelmeni, mandu, and dipping sauces. Before we get started, just a reminder that things aren't totally falling apart. KBOO Community Radio is still here for you, as it's been for the past 52 years. We're broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, despite temporarily shutting down the KBOO studios during the pandemic. Our programmers are making radio from home, while a small, dedicated staff keeps things running smoothly. We're in the middle of our fall membership drive, and we depend on these drives to fund the station. Over 80% of KBOO's annual budget comes from our members, and that can be you if it's not already. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online to kboo.fm/give. You can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Every amount you give through the end of October will be matched dollar for dollar. And speaking of neighbors and neighborhoods, we have a show to do, and it's a good one. Our first guest is Portland-based author, teacher, and mom, Karen Russell. Karen's novella, Sleep Donation, which originally came out back in 2014 in a digital-only edition, has just been published in a new print edition by Vintage Books, and its return couldn't be more timely. Sleep Donation takes place in the not-too-distant future when an insomnia crisis spreads across the world. People are dying from lack of sleep, and the only effective cure might just be worse than the disease. If you haven't already guessed, the parallels between the health crisis in the book and our current COVID-19 pandemic are uncanny. Karen Russell, welcome back to the neighborhood. This is the third time we've talked on radio since the pandemic began, and I just want to say it's been a real joy and comfort for me, and thank you for that.
Ken, thank you too. This is like an island of sanity in a truly insane time. And it's just been wonderful to have this as sort of like, these regular check-ins. We might have to just schedule them, you know, every few months, because it's increasingly difficult to process everything that's been happening.
But this book, I think, helps. I wanted to get right to that. Sleep Donation is out now in print, thanks to Vintage Press. And it was initially released as an ebook. And that was, pre-pandemic, back in 2014. The publisher was Atavist Books. Their business model at the time was digital only, not print editions. And unfortunately, that didn't work out well for them. The book has been difficult to get a hold of until this new edition, and I'm so happy it's widely available now. I was wondering, what's the story behind the new edition? Was that the idea of a Vintage to contact you and bring it out?
Yeah, well, my wise agent, I think, decided when Atavist Books folded, which was really a bummer. They were this super cool, very ambitious digital publisher helmed by Francis Cody, who's an amazing kind of legendary editor. And I was so excited to get to work with her. I had written this kind of corner of the eye, strange story about sleep and dreams, and they were looking for novella length works. And so it's sort of almost accidentally, you know, I don't think I was thinking of it as even as a book at that time. I was thinking, well, this is obviously too long to be in a story collection. It's not a novel, help, you know? And so Atavist Books put it out as an ebook, and it was beautiful, but it you know, they went out of business about 7 months later. And then this book was kind of stranded. So my wise agent, you know, got the rights back. And it was just in a little bit of a limbo. And when we sold Orange World, my story collection, you know, she sent this over to, and Vintage said, great, we'll do it as a paperback original. And I was really thrilled, you know, because it's strange to have published something that then kind of just disappears like a dream, you know? And so now I feel like,
it would have been,
you know,
a tragedy.
Books still come in and out of print, but this just feels a little more of a solid deal. And in the era of Zoom, I'm really into tactile objects. I'm into this third dimension. You know, it's cool to me. So I'm glad to be able to actually touch paper. And you know, I had told my agent, well, if we're going to do it as a book, let's try to find a way to make it a little more than just a reissue. You know, let's tune it up a little bit, and maybe they'll let me do an illustrated edition.
Oh, we'll get into that. And also there's, you added an appendix there. It's called the Nightmare Appendix.
Nightmare Appendix.
Yeah, we'll get to that too. Now, Karen, the premise of the book is that there's a pandemic, an insomnia crisis where people can't sleep. And of course that can have fatal results. They can live, you said the longest lived a person affected in the book, at least in this fictional world, was about 22 days, and then they just die of lack of sleep and everything that comes along with that. You create a world where those who aren't affected can donate sleep, hence the title, and that works as a cure for these people who can't, these insomniacs. What makes it even more interesting is that the donated sleep can also come with the donor's nightmares, with this unwanted addition, some so horrible that recipients choose not to sleep so they can avoid the bad dreams. And I read the idea for the novella started with a rejection, of all things, from New Yorker magazine. That was an image you had. There was an article they wanted to do on these imaginary devices of the future or something, or?
Yes, this was way back in 2013, and it was sort of, it was one of their theme issues. And so they asked a bunch of writers just sort of to riff on this idea, like what would be an imaginary innovation, you know, come up with some dream invention. And I came up with too many, which is always a problem for me. And I sent them over, and on the cutting room floor, they went with, it's online somewhere, you know, but this was one that they didn't choose. And it was, like a sort of like a Red Cross for insomniacs, a blood van that would come, you know, not something analogous to, you know, the Red Cross donation van that would come and take donations of dreams, you know, from healthy sleepers for these insomniacs, which is really kind of a wish fulfillment deal, you know, like who wouldn't want to Venmo a lot of sleep to a friend right now. I think that would be the greatest gift we could all give one another. And this was, you know, even before I had kids. Now, if somebody came to me at 4 a.m. and was like, swipe your card and, you know, we'll give you 2 more hours of sleep, I would pay any price, Ken.
See, I'm thinking now of kind of like the ice cream truck, which usually comes into our neighborhood on summer days.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, could you imagine?
The ice cream truck came around at midnight. I think that's exactly right. So, yeah, and I think even the tune of the ice cream truck, you know how it can sound sort of, there's a weird Doppler effect where it's kind of menacing. So I think that, right, that maybe that's exactly the tone of this, where it's sort of like, you know, like a whimsical little tune, and then the you can hear the hinge where it's sort of becoming something completely nightmarish and ominous, you know? Because I do think, you know, there was something about this image that felt both to me. It sort of felt like, depending on what angle you came at it, it could be whimsical or very menacing, or, you know, beautiful, or you know, in the way that like a dream can kind of tip into a nightmare quite easily.
Yeah, which I think the twist, of course, here is not just that sleep can be donated and act as a cure for these insomniacs, but you came up with the idea that along with that beneficial sleep comes what possibly can be these horrible nightmares that people will do anything they can to stay awake so they're not subjected to them. How did you come up with that twist?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is such a kind of a goofy premise in some ways, but I really decided to just commit to it and treat it almost like an experiment, you know, like this wide scale counterfactual. What if there was an America where you could donate sleep to dreamers? And if at first I thought it was going to be sort of satirical, I think a lot of earnest anguish kind of found its way into these pages. So I hope it's still funny. And I think it is still, I mean, the premise is just pretty goofy. So there's some sort of like, I think there's some dark humor kind of shot throughout, but I did want to sort of take the suffering of these people seriously. And so, you know, if you've ever had bad insomnia, it's completely miserable. And you feel so helpless and it warps the way that time flows, you know, the next day. And if you've ever suffered sort of recurring nightmares or any kind of trauma, really, I was thinking about that too. You know, if you have sort of like a memory set that's quite painful, if you have, you know, my dad is a Vietnam veteran, my brother used to suffer night terrors. So I feel like that was also so visceral and real to me, thinking about people, watching people you love in the grip of some kind of nightmare or trauma and the way that it repeats. You know, part of its cruelty is that it eclipses your sunlit days. Or if you have chronic pain, right? I mean, I think there are lots of, this was sort of became a metaphor that I could inhabit, I think, this whole book, you know, to think through our somatic interdependence, and also just the way that if you're in the grip of a nightmare, kind of like this shared one that I think we all find ourselves in 2020, right? And it's affecting us in different ways, but I don't think anybody is unaffected by this pandemic. You know, desperately wanting to wake into the sun of your ordinary life.
Oh, yes, I want to get into the pandemic now. And I know I've read a lot of your more recent interviews, even some back in 2014, pre-pandemic. But in the recent interviews, of course, that question has to come up, the parallels between this insomnia crisis and our current pandemic with COVID-19. Clearly, that's not something you could have foreseen when you wrote the book. Or maybe you did.
No, but... or not even, you know, not even when I... It was way back in 2018 that Vintage was like, let's do it as a paperback, you know, after Orange World. So it's been a long wait for me, actually, you know, and even last fall, I was working with these artists and sort of, I think that I couldn't have imagined launching this I really could not have. I mean, in November of last year, the coronavirus, it didn't exist. It wasn't even on anybody's radar. I mean, it's as hard as that is to, you know, I find it very difficult, actually, to remember that it actually, you know, didn't exist. It had no reality for any of us.
And in our lifetimes, none of us have really gone through this. I read that you actually did some research, though, on previous epidemics that weren't quite at this scale, like HIV, AIDS, and you had some literary antecedents, including Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. Can you talk a little bit about some of your research and influences when you initially wrote the book? pre-pandemic.
Yeah, sure thing. Pre-pandemic. And I think I was also so interested in nightmares going viral in a more metaphoric way, you know, like, you know, our sort of digital age, the velocity at which we can kind of transmit ideas and images. And as we're seeing now, sort of this secondary epidemic of misinformation that can follow in the wake of a real crisis. So that was interesting to me then. Before, you know, I didn't really have any lived experience with a pandemic like this one. But I love Blindness by Jose Saramago. I love The Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham. Carmen Maria Machado has this amazing pandemic story. I mean, I'm a big sucker for contagions in literature. But I think the one for me probably was, I loved 100 Years of Solitude. I was assigned it in high school and I just like wandered around slack-jawed in the rain of Miami, you know, for weeks after reading it. I loved it so much. And I'm sure that the plague of insomnia really imprinted on me. And that if you return to, the language is so beautiful. They're, you know, a woman whose eyes are lit up like a cat's eyes in the dark. And that's how they know that she has this new insomnia. And it's a real breakdown, you know, of memory. And, you know, it's a lexical breakdown. There are all these effects of sleeplessness that starts to sort of erase this shared history of a people. It's beautiful. So I think probably, so that's one kind of research, is just the dreams of Marquez and Saramago and all these other amazing writers.
And you were also, I read, part of a group. They were called New Right, or New
Right.
NEU,
right?
And it paired, I'd never heard of this, but it paired writers and neuroscientists, and it gave you a solid scientific foundation for the story. I mean, there's all these terms in there. There's, are they prions or prions?
Orexins? Yes, exactly. And so this is kind of, it's a funny mix, because I mean, the premise that you can donate sleep between bodies, you just have to sort of accept that. I don't really do any kind of deep dive to, you know, that's just sort of the ante, you know, to come into this world. And I think some readers really didn't want to make it. You know, I've read some reviews where on Goodreads or whatever, where people are like, that's impossible. I'm like, well, it is. That's true. But I did sort of want there to be some grounding in brain chemistry. And so I read a little bit about fatal familial insomnia and these prion diseases, where it's just sort of like a bad origami, you know, and your brain is misfolding proteins. And that didn't seem, I mean, the idea of sort of like nightmares being transmitted mind to mind, books are the original dream exchange technology. So like, you have good evidence that this is possible. Obviously, if you've ever read Stephen King, that's like, he's on the bestseller list. We're all sort of infected with his nightmares most of the time, you know, in some form or other. But I was also just, it didn't seem totally implausible to me that there could be some major disruption to people's, you know, orexin, you know, this the orexin system. You know, if you're narcoleptic, there's, you know, that's one problem. It just seemed to me like, well, what if you had some kind of hyper arousal? What if like, some, you know, and they speculate in the book, it's an open question, what caused this? How come so many millions of Americans are losing the ability to sleep? You know, is it like blue light from our computers? Have we so disrupted the natural rhythms of the planet, you know, that we're just flooded with orexin all of the time, and our regulatory, you know, system is out of whack? And I don't know, Ken, I feel like we're living some version of that right now.
More credible now.
Nobody's sleeping well right now.
Yeah, in fact, you were the first person that introduced me to the term doom scrolling. And then I started seeing it everywhere. And it basically refers to people, before they go to bed, they make the big mistake of checking Twitter or Facebook.
Yes.
And they get all the horrors of the day presented to them, and all the stress, you know, who's going to win the election, what's going to happen with the Supreme Court.
Totally. You're just
right before sleep.
All these nightmares on board. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, it's funny, insomnia is probably one of the, maybe it's the only condition where hypochondria mimics, you know, perfectly the condition itself. Like I can become so anxious about, you know, feeling like, oh my God, I'm never going to get to sleep. And that becomes its own sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. I have some neuroscientist friends who read an early draft, and I'm grateful to them because they, you know, yeah, they sent me to read about, if anybody really wants to terrify themselves, this is like the saddest condition in the world, this fatal familial insomnia. But that's my new, you know, in the uncontrolled experiment of my own life with these kids, I can tell you that more than ever, I am aware that sleep is the foundation of all human happiness and mental health.
Now, you did this wonderful interview recently in a horror journal, which I had never heard of, called Rue Morgue. They basically cover books in the horror genre, movies, television, and do a very good job of it. I'm quoting from this. What I remember about my original draft was the feeling of getting hauled into deeper waters by a powerful fish. The sensation that I'd hooked or been hooked by something larger than I anticipated. And this is something you said earlier in our conversation. I really committed to the premise, as goofy as it sounds. What if sleep could be stored and transfused between bodies? What if certain recurring nightmares were contagious? There's so much in the story, science fiction, horror, satire, touching on grief, sacrifice, greed, a critique of capitalism and technology. I mean, it's all in here. I was wondering, what was that powerful fish that first drew you in?
Thank you so much for reading that. Yeah, I did sort of feel like I had something on the line that was bigger than my original ambition, which was just to make up an invention.
You know, the ice cream man.
Like a little vignette about, yeah, the ice cream man, right. And I think, you know, what really surprised me, because I had as much fun as it was to sort of enter this Twilight Zone, you know, territory, and I had a lot of fun kind of building out the world of this story, what this kind of version of America would really look like or feel like. There's a lot of like bureaucracy. I mean, there's a slumber corps, this nonprofit, and I was really surprised at how urgent that question felt to me. Sort of, what do we owe to one another in this world where the need is bottomless? You know, what do we really owe to one another, and why is it that, to me anyway, and this is going to sound sort of childlike in this articulation, but sort of like, why is it that while people seem to have a genuine desire to give to one another, it just seems to collide with this predatory reality and result in a really warranted suspicion of our, you know, economy and institutions? I mean, I think this is sort of a real question for this woman who, you know, she on the one hand has this very genuine desire to help, and this kind of growing suspicion that this organization that she works for, you know, might be sort of corrupt at its core. And I just think it's not a stretch, right? I think any person on the street, if you said, hey, there's this precious, sleep has become so precious, it's a precious resource, you know, like it should be a birthright, but now only some can do it. How long before this becomes yet another commodity? They'd say instantly, right? Like, I just think that...
I want to get into that a little later with a book that you read after you wrote this. So,
I think that was, I suppose, like, what was interesting to me was this other question that I thought I was writing, you know, a different kind of book, and that, there's this, she's sort of on a front, she would be today called like one of our emergency frontline workers.
Oh, an essential worker.
An essential worker. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm so brain. Yes.
Yeah, and that's the narrator. It's first person narration by a character.
It's a first person narrator, and it's sort of like this crisis has now become like a permanent condition. And I was talking with Vanessa Veselka, an author I love, about watching some of the, you know, the sort of kind of provisional state, you know, where there's a lot of everyone's living in suspension, and maybe you start to give up certain freedoms, or you know, and watching that sort of get codified into a new reality, you know, these things that are just like, you know, and maybe that's going to happen to us. We'll see. Right. But I do feel like it's not, that also was a fear that sort of came into focus for me as I wrote this idea that these people who are at this moment letting their, you know, they're like, we have to scan our sleep for contagious nightmares. You know, let's see if this sleep is viable. And let's also see if there's something monstrous inside me that's going to escape me and infect others.
Which, of course, is extremely intrusive and very analogous to the information we share and is monetized by social media platforms, Google, Facebook, etc.
Yes. So that it became another language, I mean, to sort of get at what's genuinely nightmare. You know, that's a nightmare that I have, right? Like, well, how do we live in this world where we are all, we're somatically interdependent, but we're also so wired in to one another now. And we have this great little aside of the internet, which you know, they're wonderful things that have come from these platforms and technologies, but yeah, it's we're already sort of barreling into this dystopian future, I think, where there's like a real inequity in the flow of knowledge, right? In who gets to dream at all, right? And in sort of like the private material of our lives becoming, as you say, commodified or transformed into predictive AI, or, you know, just put on a different kind of assembly line. And it's scary, Ken.
oh, definitely. And the world building in here is just amazing. It takes place in, I guess, the not too distant future, maybe even somewhat of a fictional present. Not that fictional, yeah. Though. It's an unnamed city in Pennsylvania. You were living in Philadelphia, I think, at the time when you conceived the story. And that conversation with Vanessa Veselka, I should mention, she has a new novel, The Great Offshore Grounds.
It is a masterpiece. Anybody listening should pick up this book. It is. I mean, people use that word quite often. And I think in the old school, non-hyperbolic sense, it is truly like, it's just this amazing epic that also sort of subverts all your expectations of an epic. And I loved it. So
you're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, we're previewing the upcoming Portland Book Festival with two authors who will be appearing at the event. Karen Russell, author of the novella Sleep Donation, just released in a print edition for the first time by Vintage, and Liz Crane, author of the new cookbook, Dumplings Equal Love, Delicious Recipes from Around the World, from Seattle Sasquatch Books. And it was a wonderful conversation. I don't know if it's still available, if it was recorded. It was through a bookstore. But you said in that conversation that committing to a strange premise, this what you call this goofy premise, gives you the constraints needed to create a world. How did committing to the premise of Sleep Donation give you those needed constraints? Is it that if you don't have the constraints, you can just go off in any direction and you start getting this kind of stew of all these weird ideas and no focus?
Yeah, I think that is, and that is a real particular challenge of mine. I think I have this really kind of like, it sort of like reminds me of Floridian ecology, you know, where it's just, it feels like a tree can sprout in your yard overnight, you know, or it's just like you're totally overtaken by foliage. So I feel like I have a real generative imagination, and sometimes in a way that's not at the service of telling a story. You know what I mean? It can just be so fecund and sort of, and it's a real tension for me sort of between my desire to kind of walk around and explore a world and, you know, tell a linear story with real stakes. I was talking to a video game designer. I promise this is relevant, or I hope it is. This is the problem. You're witnessing my problem.
Okay. You're going off in all directions.
This is my proof of concept. Yeah, but he was telling me like they had made this game that was exclusively exploratory. You could just swim around the sea and like check stuff out, and people didn't really enjoy it. They wanted an imperative. You know, they wanted a goal and they wanted an antagonist, you know,
they wanted a story.
They also wanted, they wanted a balance of the two, right? When it was too sort of narrow and just the forward tilt of battle, that was also kind of boring. You know, people wanted to live in the world. So I think there's something analogous there, that just sort of balancing different pleasures, you know, wanting something that has stakes and momentum, and maybe also wanting to know like, well, what's happening on the periphery of this place? Who lives there? You know, what is, you know, what's the sky look like, right? What's the weather today? And I think having that constraint really, it's sort of like, I mean, Swift is somebody that I reread when I was writing this.
Because
at some
proposal.
Point I thought it was going to be my version of A Modest Proposal, right? Where we all just steal sleep from babies in our rapacious economy. And I would kind of satirize that. And then, you know, living boots on the ground in this world, it just, I ended up caring about these people, which in some ways inhibited a certain kind of, you know, it made it harder that I wasn't going to make jokes at the expense of this particular baby whose life I cared about. But thinking about, okay, well, if we really could transfuse sleep between bodies, so then what happens? And what happens if, you know, in the middle of this story, as you mentioned, a nightmare taints the sleep supply. And now there's a new problem, right? It's like, now there's this escalation where people are dying of insomnia that's volitional because they're terrified to go to sleep. This dream is so awful that they just won't sleep. So getting to sort of follow I think the fish is a good, you know, holding on to this like giant fish and just seeing where it's going to lead, you know, but really trying to be rigorous about modeling the scenario, you know, given the kind of constraints of the premise, what would that really look like? And I do think there's something, you know, the neuroscientists taught me about an experiment, you know, and having this simulated world that still operates by the rules of human nature that we know, you know what I mean? Like, I hope that the human personality is inside it, and the way that sort of people behave as a collective feels true to what you could imagine might happen, you know, if this were the case.
Now, before we go, we should talk about the Portland Book Festival. By the way, it's going all virtual this year, so it will be available to everybody all over the world, actually. I didn't mean that. That will be your nightmare tonight. Yeah. But you have at least two events there, incredible events. One where you're in conversation with Margaret Atwood and the other with Carl Hiaasen. And with Atwood, I think one obvious topic is how prescient your books are, hers with, of course, The Handmaid's Tale, what's happening now with the Supreme Court and the possible overturning of Roe v. Wade, or certainly our fears about that, and yours with this insomnia crisis that mirrors our current COVID-19 pandemic. Is that something, are you the one asking the questions in that, or have you come up with some of the material yet?
I'm so nervous about this. I wish that you could do it and just say, you know, maybe I could, like, we just could do some ventriloquy, you know, some like an old school con, because I'm in the interviewer seat. And as we discovered, you know, I had such a blast interviewing my brother, but it can get a little digressive, you know? So I think I really have to, yeah, make sure I have my index cards with my questions and just, you know, drink a pot of coffee and put on Clydesdale blinders and really try to, I think it's a very hard job, I think, to be the interviewer. Being the interviewee, in my experience, is just a pleasure and a much easier job. You generally know the answers to the questions. You get to feel, you know, seen and known by another intelligence, and it's a blast. I feel like in the interview seat, oh my goodness, you know.
Oh, I think you have a lot in common as great writers.
But I love both of those writers so much. And I'm reading Squeeze Me right now. I haven't totally finished it. And it's so funny.
Oh, that's a new Carl Hiaasen.
It's so funny. And it's also set, somehow he's written a book that is just about this moment. It doesn't seem like it should be temporally possible, but he did it. And it's, you know, it's Florida during this pandemic. And it's just so truly hilarious. And I'm so grateful to somebody, speaking of nightmares, for like alchemizing the nightmare, you know, metabolizing it into humor for us. That's a real service to the world. And Margaret Atwood, unsurprisingly, is a very brilliant poet. I feel like, as a failed poet myself, you know, or just I love sentences, and I love the way that one word, the friction between words, you know, just sort of like the micro pulse of language. So I'm really excited to talk to her about, you know, what it's like to go from writing these trilogies, you know, these not just kind of worlds, but whole universes, to kind of the distilled magic of her poems.
Well, I really look forward to that. And it will be virtual online, and people can sign up for these online and listen.
You know, it's amazing. How is it possible to be afraid of everything at once? That's my parting question, Ken. Like, how is it possible to be afraid of, you know, being seen by everyone and being ignored by everyone? Like, it's how are both, like, you know, or just, I'm continually amazed at my ability to be afraid of every outcome. But hopefully these are going to be warm. It's Portland books, you know, it's going to be a warm crowd. You know, that's what I keep telling myself. It's going to be people who love books, the best people. So.
Oh yeah. And I'm so glad they found a way to keep it going. It's a tradition here in Portland. And now, like I say, it'll be available again, and hopefully we'll do it live in person next year in 2021. Well, yeah. Karen, again, thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's always a wonderful day in the neighborhood when you are here.
Oh, thank you, Ken. You know, with all the mailman in the neighborhood going postal and the sky really falling. It's a joy to have just a serene conversation with you. And I thank you for your reading. It means the world to me. Thanks for having me back on the show.
We've been talking with Karen Russell, author of the novella Sleep Donation, just released in a print edition for the first time by Vintage. Karen will be appearing at the upcoming Portland Book Festival, which is going entirely online this year, like just about everything else. Our next guest will also be there at the festival, Liz Crane, author of the new cookbook, Dumplings Equal Love, from Seattle's Sasquatch Books. I've had the pleasure of talking with Liz several times for KBOO, most recently for last year's Portland Book Festival, when she hosted a panel with cookbook authors Andrea Nguyen and The Joy of Cooking's Megan Scott and John Becker. We also talked with her last year for the 10th annual Portland Fermentation Festival, which Liz organizes along with Heidi Nessler and Claudia Lucero. And I should mention she interviewed Master Chef Edward Lee for KBOO's Between the Covers when his most recent book, Buttermilk Graffiti, was published. In addition to Dumplings Equal Love, Liz is the author of Food Lover's Guide to Portland and co-author of the cookbooks Toro Bravo and Hello, My Name is Tasty, as well as Grow Your Own, Understanding, Cultivating, and Enjoying Cannabis. She's a longtime writer on Pacific Northwest food and drink, and her writing has appeared in Lucky Peach, Food and Wine, Sun Magazine, The Progressive, and The Guardian. Dumplings Equal Love, by the way, was recently included in Food and Wine Magazine's 50 cookbooks we're diving into this fall, which is a great honor for any cookbook author. Liz, thanks so much for joining us today remotely, of course, which makes me miss the KBOO studios even more, since you usually bring in food samples when we do these interviews in person.
Yeah, I love it, Ken, because we're both like book lovers and food lovers. So
oh, yes.
Always fun to share some treats when we get to see each other or go out for a nice meal.
Oh,
long
yes.
Overdue.
I miss those.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, you start the new book with a personal story on how you were first introduced to dumplings as a 10-year-old growing up in Cincinnati. Can you tell us that story and why that first taste of dumplings was such a lasting memory for you?
Yeah, so growing up, I always had a really curious palate. I just always wanted to, if I tried something that I loved, I wanted to make it at home. So, you know, like we had Orange Julius in the mall and I loved those orange vanilla drinks. So then I got home and made my own with a little Cool Whip container and some orange juice. But the dumpling love came from a Chinese restaurant that we went to quite regularly that was maybe 20 minutes away from our house. And we ordered their shumai, which is a really classic pork and shrimp dumpling. It's pleated and it has an open top. They're just really savory and juicy and usually have a lot of either Chinese chives or scallions in them. And yeah, we ordered a steamer tray of them. That's the first time that I had, you know, dumplings arrive at a table with the lid, the bamboo lid on the steamer tray still on them. And then, you know, our server lifted them up and the lid off of it. And yeah, it was just dreamy. I think like handmade dumplings, and they did everything from scratch there. There's so much love that can be put into them because, you know, you're taking the time to make the dough and put the filling in just so, and just kind of make it into a little edible art piece. So yeah, that was really memorable. And then after that, I was just kind of chasing dumplings whenever I had the opportunity.
Yeah, which was amazing for me. That particular dumpling, you're talking about a shumai, but there's several other types of dumplings in the book, which I never realized were dumplings. Chinese wonton, which I think was my first introduction in New York at a Chinese restaurant to dumplings. Japanese gyozas, Jewish kreplach, Russian pelmeni, Korean mandu. So maybe it's a good idea at this point to talk a little about what makes a dumpling and how prevalent it is in so many different cultures.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't believe that there is any culture in the world that does not have a dumpling or hundreds of dumplings for that matter. But I think like the definition, I'm not that into labels. So, I mean, a dumpling could be, if you're thinking about it etymologically, the dump in, you know, the 16th century meant a tiny little lump, and the ling, the end of the word, meant small. So it's like a small lump. So when you're thinking of like,
not very
doesn't
appetizing.
Sound very edible. No. But that's like when you're thinking of things like spoon dumplings, like chicken and dumplings, or, you know, dumplings that don't have a filling like gnocchi. And so my preferred type of dumpling generally is a dumpling that has a thin skin that's usually made of flour, and then it's filled with something either savory or sweet, typically savory, and then has, you know, dipping sauces that you can kind of dip into. But yeah, they just like ferments, you know, I love fermentation. There's just such a wide variety of dumplings around the world. And I have yet to meet anyone who does not like dumplings, because to say that you don't like dumplings, I mean, that would be just that there are thousands of different types, you know, all around the world. But I think like most of us when we're thinking of dumplings, we'll often be thinking about Chinese dumplings and dumplings from Asia. And most people would agree that those are roughly about 2000 years old from the Han Dynasty when flour milling became prevalent. But I don't know. I think like if you want to call it a dumpling and it's something that you've made with your hands, and I'm not going to argue. It's like, what's a sandwich or what's a burrito? I don't know. Yeah.
Exactly. Those are also prevalent in many different cultures, the variations on sandwiches, burritos. Now, you write in the introduction to the book that it had its origins while you were dining out with the publisher, Sasquatch, who you've worked with on at least two previous books, and you were eating dumplings. So I was wondering, is that how you all came up with the subject, or was this something you had been thinking about for some time?
Yeah, it was 2 years ago at Portland Book Festival, and that's coming up. That's just around the corner, obviously. That's why we're talking. But yeah, we went out to dinner at Tasty and Alder. Rest in peace, Tasty and Alder. And we ordered a whole bunch of different items from the menu. There were several of us there. Sasquatch also published Hello, My Name is Tasty, and my first book, Food Lover's Guide to Portland. But one of the dishes that the kitchen sent out was goat cheese arrabbiata dumplings. We hadn't ordered them. It was just a nice thing to do on the house. And I just started talking about dumplings because I love them so much. I love making them with my nieces. And it's kind of a family tradition for the holidays to make round after round of dumplings. And, you know, they could sense my enthusiasm. I was talking a lot. And then, you know, the president looked at the editorial director and said, you know, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And she said, yeah, you should write a dumpling cookbook for us. So it was pretty magical. I love that, you know, it was a book that was conceived at the Portland Book Festival, if you will. And it's just like, that's a really great way to come up with an idea for a cookbook, just with really great people that you love sitting around a table and talking about delicious food.
And of course, I have to ask, but it's the obvious question, the equation. Why do dumplings equal love?
You know, it's just sort of, for me, I think that we all have these sort of dishes or things that we do for people when they're not feeling well, you know, either, you know, going through something difficult work-wise or just not feeling well, feeling sick. And, you know, some people make lasagna, some people make big vats of soup and bring them over to people. And for me, it's always been dumplings. I always make all different types of dumplings for people when they're not feeling well. And then for myself too. And I think that they equal love. I mean, I think that whatever food you're making, it's what you put into it. If you're caring about someone, I definitely like show my love for people through cooking for them. But dumplings in particular, just the fact that you're hand forming them, you are making them, you're taking care with the presentation, and it's often meager ingredients that you're putting into them. But when someone is eating a dumpling that you made for them, they're thinking of, oh, you know, the time that it took to put together. And yeah, I think that they just always make people feel better.
Now the dumplings we mentioned, a lot of them in the book are from the particular cultures, mostly from Asia. But you do have a section called Dumplings Beyond Asia, which I loved. It includes, I'll just name a few, sour pickle pierogi, your own recipe, Cincinnati chili XLBs. XLBs, for people who don't know, that's a soup dumpling, which is very popular now. shrimp and grits XLB, kind of a New Orleans influence, and even a dessert dumpling, a bananas Foster with cocoa skins. Can you talk a little bit about those, Liz, and how you came up with the ideas and recipes? They're very creative.
Yeah, I knew I wanted to have some Pacific Northwest dumplings for sure. And that to me often means foraging, since we have so many great foraged foods here. So I have a morel sherry cream dumpling with smoked paprika skins, and then a nettle and caramelized onion dumpling. Of course, you can find those things in other areas of the country as well, but that's sort of my love letter to Pacific Northwest, those two recipes. For me, it's that familial and celebratory aspect that I wanted to have some recipes from growing up. And so I'm from Cincinnati, and the shrimp and grits dumpling is actually that there's a garlic cheese grit casserole that's the kind of backbone of those dumplings. And that's an old family recipe that anytime we are having get together or holiday time in Cincinnati, my family, we're always going to have that on the table. So it's kind of bringing that into a dumpling I knew I wanted to do. And then the sour pickle pierogi are really fun. Those are from another rest in peace business in Portland, the Foggy Notion. So it's my friends Vinny and Mel, and they made pierogi once a week there. And it's their recipe with some, you know, minor adjustments and adding the sour pickle to it. But yeah, it was really fun for me to come up with the list. And I almost want to do another cookbook right away because there's just so many great dumplings. You can get so creative with them. But I also have a lot of the classics too. Like you said, the Korean mandu and Japanese gyoza and the Xiaolong Bao, the soup dumplings.
Oh, a quick question. You mentioned in the book, since we were on the Xiaolong Bao, the XLB, that the first time you had one, you weren't quite sure how to eat them. This is kind of shamefully, for my own benefit, how do you eat an XLB? Do you put the whole thing in your mouth?
I think that's a danger zone. That's like reaching for a slice of pizza too quickly when it's just out of the oven.
Could be hot. Burn your tongue.
Yeah, it can really be. They can come out piping hot because it's just, you know, it's essentially cubed and gelatinized broth that then, so you're just putting a big ball of soup in your mouth. I kind of nibble off a part of the top and then see how much steam comes out. And if it's, you know, like a steam train, then I'm going to wait a second. But if it's not, then you can just sort of slurp up a little bit. And then if it's, you know, if I want a little more extra flavor, like they're typically served with black vinegar and julienne ginger in it, then I might add a little bit of, you know, dipping sauce to it. But then I just sort of eat, depends on what they're served in. But if they're served in soup spoons, then I'll just kind of to eat on it with my chopsticks, eat the dumpling over the soup spoon. But yeah, I've seen some really, really huge ones where it's almost like, it looks like it might be a cup of broth in it. And then
you don't want to put all that in your mouth.
No, but you can get like a thick straw and kind of poke it into the dumpling and then suck up the broth through the straw. I haven't done that. I prefer kind of a more one or two bite soup dumpling myself. But I'm really glad that in the book, I'm glad you brought up soup dumplings because I thought that they would be very complicated to make at home, and they can be like anything, but I found a way to make soup dumplings for vegans, vegetarians, and pescatarians by instead of using animal-based gelatin, I'm using algae-based agar-agar, and it kind of sets up like Jell-O does, and it sort of looks like it comes typically in a powder. You can also get it in sticks or flakes, but yeah, you just kind of make your Jell-O-ish version of your broth, slice it up, and then mix it with whatever ingredients. So for the vegan one, it's mushroom, shiitakes and crimini's or whatever mushrooms you want to use. And then I have shrimp ones that I really like, but those were fun. It was just a nice treat because oftentimes you go into a recipe thinking, oh, this one's really going to kick my butt. I'm going to have to spend a lot of time on it. And then to have it just be such an ease. And then other ones that you think will be easy and then they take forever, like the gluten-free dough. That was really hard for me to get that.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the gluten-free, and also that there's options for every diet in there. There's vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free, of course, meat eaters, too. Now, Liz, you've been appearing at the Portland Book Festival for several years now, both as a panel moderator and an author. And we're happy to say your streak's intact for this year's virtual festival. As of today, I checked again this morning as we're recording the interview. The schedule hasn't been released, just the participating authors. Can you give us any information without revealing any secrets so far on your event, date and time, maybe?
I don't have a date and time for any of... I think I'm doing three different events, but I can say one thing that I'm excited about. You know, every year for the Portland Book Festival, we always have the pop-up readings in the Portland Art Museum.
Oh, yes, yes, very popular.
They're so popular. And of course, it's virtual this year, but... we're still doing those. So I will be, you know, paired with a piece of art, and I will be there with my Dumplings Equal Love book and my mask on, and we'll be kind of recording those, and those will be aired during the festival. I do know, like, what I can say as a teaser just for one of my events is it's going to be very, very creative in the pairings. So I will be paired with another author who is not a cookbook author, and we'll be talking about sort of storytelling through the context of food. That's all I can say. But yeah, I don't think that we have any of the dates nailed down yet, but it's November 5th through the 21st. It's all free. There are a few events that it's like buy a book as a ticket, but yeah, that's just so cool. That I feel like this year I'll finally be able, I'm usually doing events at the festival or working at the book fair, but I'll get to go to so many of the events because for the most part, I think there will be no simultaneous events this year. So, you know, you log on to the website and for, the 5th through the 21st, all kinds of great authors like Marcus Samuelson, Margaret Atwood. Yeah, it's one of my favorite events of the year. So
yeah, it's definitely an advantage of the virtual because I have that dilemma every year. There's two or three events I want to see at the same time. So what do you pick? And you can't catch up on them later. So, and also at the festival, as much as I love it, sometimes you're in line there. If you don't arrive in time, you might not get into a session. So the virtual, I think, should work out well. But in any case, it's great that it's still continuing. Liz, again, thanks so much for joining us. And you had even made an offer where I can pick up some frozen dumplings a little later in the month. And so I appreciate that. And I'll be using my own steamer here at home and very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, I definitely have a bag of shrimp and grits dumplings for you all.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
That your name is on that. And then I think a medley of my freezer is just... my freezer is basically just like a big box of dumplings. It's pretty great. Yeah. But thank you so much. It was really nice to talk to you as always and to see you.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Karen Russell and Liz Crane. Karen's latest book is a new edition of her 2014 novella Sleep Donation from Vintage Books, in print for the first time, and with added material, including illustrations and a special nightmare appendix. Liz's new work is the cookbook Dumplings Equal Love, Delicious Recipes from Around the World from Sasquatch Books. Karen and Liz are both scheduled to appear at the upcoming Portland Book Festival, which takes place entirely online this year from November 5th through the 21st. Karen has two events, a conversation with Carl Hyacin, on Monday, November 9th at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, and another conversation not to be missed with Margaret Atwood on Tuesday, November 17th at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. And Liz shares the virtual stage with best-selling novelist Megha Majumdar on Wednesday, November 18th at 1:30 p.m. Pacific Time.
Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, November 27th at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then. In the meantime, many thanks to the KBOO staff, Jenna, Celeste, Arthur, Tammy, Asia, Althea, Selena, Jenka, Otto, and others who are keeping the station running while almost everyone else at the station is staying safe and making radio from home. You can show your support for their efforts in KBOO Community Radio by becoming a member during our fall membership drive, and if you're already a member, it's a perfect time to renew. You can do that by giving online at kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thanks to all of you for listening and for keeping us going these past 52 years. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, may there be better and more beautiful days ahead, and pretty darn soon.